interview with Forrest Talbot took place on November 21st, 1985. The interview is part of a joint effort between the Columbia University Oral History Project and the Foundation for Iranian Studies.
Pittsburgh, but I was raised mainly in Wisconsin and Illinois because I come from an Illinois family. And grew up in public schools in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, outside of Milwaukee, and then University of Illinois, class of 1936.
Mm-hmm. So you did a BA?
No, I did two BAs. One liberal arts and just not political science, the other in journalism.
Mm-hmm. After you graduated from college, what was your, how did you make a living?
I went to work for Discovery Data News as a cub reporter.
And you were there through the 30s or through the late 30s?
I was there a couple of years. And then I got a chance at a fellowship that took me ultimately to India. And I began my India studies in 1938 for the year in England at the Indian Civil Service Probationers Place. And then 2 years in India. One on the Muslim side, another on the Hindu side.
Were you at a university there? Or?
In my Muslim year, I was half the year at the university and half the year in a village in Kashmir. On the Hindu side, I was mainly in ashrams and some urban settings.
Then World War II came along, you served in the...
Served in the Navy, in Bombay for 2 years, in Chongqing for 2 years. Then back in Washington, and then I went right back to the Chicago Daily News and became their correspondent in South Asia, Southeast Asia, at the time of the transfer of power from Britain to India and the partition of India.
What do you do your duties in the Navy?
Naval liaison officer Bombay and assistant naval attache in Chongqing.
And then after the war, you were back with the Daily News in India. From then, how long were you with the Daily News again?
A couple of years until the new independent nations of India and Pakistan were established. And then I went back to Chicago and took a doctorate at the University of Chicago in international relations. And then got involved in founding an inter-university organization called the American Universities Field Staff. Which was really an academic foreign service. American, mainly scholars, who were specialists in foreign areas, studying and writing on those areas and returning to the campuses of the sponsoring universities for periods of lecture and so on.
Was funded American scholars going overseas? Yes,
that's right.
So it was very broad gauge.
Very broad.
Was it like a privately funded or?
Funded mainly by the universities that were members, corporate members, and by foundations.
What was your position with this?
The executive director for 10 years.
Did that, was it mostly third world oriented or just?
Largely, we didn't call it third world, we call it those parts of the world that are least known to Americans.
And you were with that through the 50s?
That's right. Until I was invited into government at the beginning of the 1960s.
How did it come about that you were appointed as Assistant Secretary of State for Air Research?
I'm not entirely sure, but my belief is that because I was known to both Dean Rusk and Chuck Bowles, they were the ones who put up my name. People in the White House have never heard of him. I knew that.
Did you know Russ through his Rockefeller Foundation?
That's correct, yes.
And,
actually, we had met briefly in India during World War II when he was a colonel out there. And I'd known Bowles also in India.
During the wartime period?
Not during the wartime, when he first became ambassador in 1950, just
So they help bring you in, basically, with their influence. When you became Assistant Secretary, what were your general responsibilities? What your
18 countries, State Department divided the world into five different regional areas, and mine extended from the Eastern Arab countries and Israel through Turkey, Iran, and Afghanistan, the subcontinent right to Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka.
How did the division run on a sort of day-to-day basis? How did it work in terms of practice? Did you meet with desk officers constantly, or how did the work process
occur? Obviously, foreign policy brings in a number of different elements. Within the State Department, the geographic bureaus had primary responsibility for developing programs and policies and maintaining relationships with our embassies and consulates in the area and with those governments. But the work of the geographic bureaus always interrelated with the functional bureaus, like Bureau of Economic Affairs and so on, that had global oversight. And in addition, of course, we were responsible for liaison with AID, with agriculture, with commerce, with treasury, with the Pentagon, other governmental agencies. And we reported essentially to what's called in the State Department the seventh floor, the secretary and the undersecretaries.
Do you prefer directly to Russ, or did you with the undersecretaries more often than you dealt with Russ?
It depended on the level of concern about a particular area at a particular time. Russ was the secretary for much of the period. George Ball was the undersecretary, and then there were others. I dealt primarily with those two while they were there. I reported primarily to those two.
Mm-hmm. Who did you rely upon for advice and information when it came to Iranian issues? Who were the main people you worked with when it came to decisions on Iran at this time?
On a day-to-day basis, the Iran desk was at the point of all advice organization and our consultations. All copies of telegrams from the embassy in Iran were received by me, often by the secretary, but particularly by the Iran desk. And when the telegram would refer to something that was of an earlier period that I wasn't familiar with, or in some depth that I wasn't familiar with, it was normally the Iran desk that to which I turned for information. However, the pattern broadened very rapidly and very widely on this, because AID, as it now is, and the other agencies had very strong interests in Iran. And so we would have different levels of meetings constantly to be sure that there was a coordinated U.S. government position on the issues that came up.
Did much of this go to the NSC? Was that sort of like coordinating focus for or less so?
There was an NSC representative, Robert Comer, who sat in on the interagency talks that we had. We tried, sometimes once a week, to have a luncheon that included the half a dozen people that were most involved around the government in this case, Iran. It could have been Israel, it could have been Turkey or any other country in the region. And usually, most of these people at the weekly luncheon had responsibilities for the same general area. A variety of people. I mentioned Comer, Bill Gaud of AID was a considerable factor. There would be different people from Pentagon, but usually it was somebody from ISA, International Security Affairs. who was there. There'd be an agency man there, usually a man or a woman. USIA would have somebody there, but that would change too. The lists are available, but it is the Treasury is much interested, although I don't remember a very senior person in Treasury participating in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Who is the country desk person at this point? Do you remember the name of the person?
Well, Robert Miner was the head of what we call GTI, which was Greece, Turkey, Iran. And he was at the next level down, reported to me from those three countries.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had assistants dealing with each of the countries.
Specialist,
yes. He was a specialist. There was a woman named Catherine Bracken, who was one of his specialists. There were several others who were at various stages of seniority and who ultimately became more and more responsible. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they became desk officers.
Was this task force the first major Iran issue that came up when you were Assistant Secretary?
Yes, yes.
Some of the issues, the concerns that led to its formation, what inspired it?
Basically, it was a sense that 7 or 8 years had passed since the Shah's return, that there were concerns about the direction in which Iran was going, and about our relationships with him. The Shah was pressing for more aid. We needed a coordinated U.S. government position on this. The different elements of the government were not agreeing at the beginning of that administration. There's been a very vigorous involvement with Iran during the Eisenhower administration. We're starting with the return of the Shah. There was a feeling that we needed to look at what American interests in Iran really were. And get, as they say, our ducks in order. And this was really it. There's an effort to get agreement in the U.S. government on what Iran's real needs were. As usual, the differences between those who thought that military aid was the best solution and those who thought that economic and social development were more important. There were concerns already about what we now call human rights there, questions as to whether the U.S. was supporting things going on in Iran that it didn't really care for, and so on. So all these questions came up. It was an examination of the Iranian situation that set the tone, I think, for the next year or two. Although I have to add that later, Ambassador Holmes felt that we've been too doctrinaire, if you will, too much concerned about somebody else's economic and social cultural problems, and not enough concerned about sustaining the Shah as an important feature in this region.
A report that I read that was by John Bowling, who was involved in these issues apparently, suggested that there was some concern in early 61 that the Shah might drift into sort of a neutralist posture. Was that why we felt concerned at that time? Or?
That was a part of it.
Yeah.
And was part of the argument for involving in more in terms of military assistance and duty. I'd have to say that at the beginning of the 60s, the U.S. government wanted to have good, solid relations with the Shah, but was not prepared to make him a surrogate in the region. I think from 72 onwards it changed quite substantially.
When the task force was set up considering the issue of Iran, what kind of policy options did it consider? Do you recall any of them? What would be the best approach to take?
I think I've indicated that there were those who argued in favor of essentially a military-based relationship, that the primary concerns were security concerns. But as far as the United States' interest in Iran went, and the importance of the Persian Gulf was pointed out and all the rest of it, there were others who felt that the internal strength and stability of Iran depended upon the Shah's relationship to his own people, on modernization and development programs, and that side of the picture. There was some considerable concern about the human rights situation in Iran.
I guess what I meant to say is that, well, if we talk about Boeing, what I've seen suggested that he laid out like several options in terms of support of the Shah. One was to maybe support the National Front types, give them more political support, or support a conservative military group, or support the Shah, support the Shah and expand American support for the Shah as the central focus of Iranian politics, or just to continue the existing policy of trying to get them to liberalize a little bit. Were those options laid out that?
I think that paper was circulated.
And
Berlin was in part doing his own thinking, mm-hmm. and in part expressing the views of different groups. So he was personally involved, but also repertorially involved.
Mm-hmm. It was like sort of a think piece that he worked out. Was there like real serious discussion, say, supporting the National Front as opposed to the Shah, or was ever actually brought up as an option?
Everything was discussed.
Yeah.
And the question of whether the Shah could survive, given the course he was taking, what would happen if the Shah were to disappear by whatever reasons, held assassination, whatever. These were all discussed. I don't have the papers in front of me, but I understand that somebody has gotten them under freedom of information.
Apparently some of them are. Not all of them, though. Some documents have been. Some of them are, they're sanitized in parts. You really can't tell what the considerations were discussed for. What were the task force final recommendations to the extent that you can remember them?
What Julius Holmes was sent out with a brief to encourage the Shah to open up the system somewhat, to get more public involvement in public life, to look to cultural and economic advances, but not to undermine the Shah, or to encourage real alternatives. In other words, the Shah remained the force and the influence with which we were dealing.
When officials discuss Iran at this point, early 1961 or so, how important was Iran as a country to Kennedy administration officials? How what was its value as a, what kind of interest did they have there? How did they, how did they conceive their interest in Iran, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, it was definitely important. The task force was set up only because it was regarded as important. It was the first task force set up during the Kennedy administration for that part of the world. There wasn't any task force at that time for Israel or for the Arab states or for the subcontinent or anything else. So it was regarded as key. And the reasons were multiple. The Baghdad Pact had only recently run into severe trouble and been converted into center. The oil industry was a great significance in the recovery of Europe and Japan, and also in terms of world fuel supplies. Prices were low then, of course, we didn't know it, but as compared to the later times, it was certainly low. The potential for difficulties in the Gulf region were strong. Immediately after the British ended their responsibility for Kuwait, Iraq made moves which the Kuwaitis interpreted as threatening, trying to take it over. There were problems with the Kurds, who of course live in Iran, Iraq, and Turkey, and so they affected all three. There was a sharp awareness that any serious difficulty in the Persian Gulf would have global repercussions.
Now, was there concern at this time? Back to the task force deliberation. Was there concern that the Shah's position was sort of basically unstable, or was there, how concerned were they about the stability of the situation in Iran at that time?
Well, that's where one of the differences
appeared.
There were those who felt that he was firmly in control, and others who felt that the students, some other groups, were really not under his control, and that instability was definitely possible. And, this was one of the issues discussed.
So you said Holmes was recommended to take instructions, had instructions to go to the Shah and try to alter his position in some way, or get him to reform a bit?
Well, the end of the feeling was that, our posture should be one of encouraging the Shah to look to reforms that seem to us important, and to look actively to broaden the system of government, the support for government, so that the instability would be decreased.
How responsive was the Shah to Holmes' suggestions at that point?
In a way, fairly responsive. Among the American ambassadors in Iran after the 1953 period, Holmes was almost the last who could have a semi-avuncular relationship with the Shah. He was senior, he was experienced, the Shah was young, he'd been back in power only 8 years. Afterwards, we sent ambassadors who did not have that kind of seniority relationship with the Shah at all, and the relationship to the American ambassador changed substantially. Now it went up and down. Some of our ambassadors have been more influential with the Shah than otherwise, But later, Ambassador dealt with Aishah, who had greater self-confidence and determination to do what he wanted to. Holmes, I really was able to talk with Aishah on a quite open basis. And it was about this time that the Shah decided to go ahead with an active development program, the so-called White Revolution, or People's Revolution, as they call it sometimes, in order to get more economic development more broadly. Although I don't think he was terribly responsive in such things as the role of Sabak. The single-minded control of any sort of agitation, nor was he able, apparently, to stamp out evidences of corruption, including perhaps on high basis.
Apparently one move the Shah made, it was May of 61, was he appointed Ali Amini, Prime Minister. This move made in response to American pressure. I've got some impression that there was some U.S. pressure, but it's not clear to me. That's part of it.
I never know how to define American pressure or no pressure.
Yeah.
Clearly, we felt and conveyed to the Shah that we thought a more moderate-minded, vigorous prime minister would be helpful than these goals, which we were talking about, with which he agreed in his discussions. We were encouraged by the appointment of the prime minister. I'm not aware, I certainly don't remember that we were ever crass enough to say to him, look, this is the man for you to put in.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah, later on, he made some kind of accusatory statements about what happened at that point, but it's hard to evaluate them, you know, say. But I remember hearing someone suggested to me at one point that he had given special assistance, foreign aid, a grant or something like that, in order to make the decision. But it's not clear whether that was
exactly. Well, this issue of the hidden foreign hand comes up in country after country. And normally speaking, or often enough, a decision that's unpopular with some element of within a country or not is ascribed to American pressure as a way of making it accepted. Whereas, in fact, it frequently is the decision of the local leader that, for generalized reasons, perhaps including questions of aid availability and such, he needs to make some moves, and this is these moves he's going to make. We thought of that as a constructive move.
One document that I saw suggested that officials hoped that the appointment of Amini would sort of turn the Shah into more of a constitutional monarch. So he had a regular sort of a prime minister who would have major authority in the country. Was that talked about at that point?
It was certainly talked about. On the ground that stability would be strengthened in the country if there were broader participation in public processes and government. And I think that there was a feeling in Washington at that time that the concept of the all-powerful monarch was not going to survive forever.
Did you talk about these questions with Rusk, questions of the Shah and Amini at this point, or no, early 61? Did you discuss these things with him at any length, or...?
Regularly reported to him on the deliberations of the task force, and he would have reactions to them. I don't know that I'd characterize these as long discussions, but certainly he was kept informed all the time. And I, all the time, had an impression of his own reactions to what we were doing.
Do you have any special input that he made into the policy?
Only in these comments that he would make that I would think about and then carry back to the group.
Did you raise this from a Kennedy's position? President Kennedy's position was towards these matters. Did you ever talk about it or meet with them and other officials?
I recall meeting with him fewer times on Iran than on several other issues that came up during that period. The NSC representative who spoke for Mac Fundy and presumably for the president was a very active participant. Sometimes he was expressing his own views, and sometimes he was relaying attitudes in the White House.
This is Comer.
Comer.
Yeah.
And we usually had a pretty good idea which was which.
Well, this is the point, though, when the State Department's views had some primacy in the policymaking process. I mean, was there the NSC had a strong influence? The NSC advisor, Fundy, did he have a strong influence in policymaking? Was he more?
My relations with Comer, and with Mac Fundy, but especially Comer, who was sort of given charge in our area, were open and frank, candid. Sometimes we agreed, sometimes we disagreed. He presented his views vigorously because he's a vigorous person, and I would present our summations. I don't recall any occasion when they really overruled us. Especially in that task force period when we were meeting very frequently on Iran, the point was to get to some kind of consensus, and we usually managed.
When Amini became Prime Minister, I guess, May or June of 61, was there any effort to sort of work with him and give him special support in preparing a reform program of some sort? Was Holmes encouraged to,
indeed. And he was treated as Prime Minister. This didn't mean that Holmes stopped seeing the Shah, or stopped discussing great strategic issues with the Shah, and so on and so on. But a fair amount of the day-to-day business, which had to do with aid programs, which had to do with positions to be taken in international bodies, all sorts of things were done with it.
Did State Department officials have some sort of view of what they would hope he could accomplish, or specific view of what they would have liked him to accomplish? Did they talk about things that they think would be useful for him to do, or was it much more indirect than that? Or
you mean in terms of specific policies? The answer is yes, there were certain things. In the aid program, for example, we were very much interested in institution building and infrastructure building. Rather urged the Iranian government to pursue those lines, as indeed that government did reasonably well in some areas. Similarly, we argue and urge in favor of certain positions at the UN or in the regional organizations or something of that sort. So that was done. Obviously, our posture was the benefits of an opening up of political and social and economic activities.
I had the impression that through this period, Walt Rostow, among others, I suppose, was trying to encourage countries like Iran to develop a sort of pro-Western middle class that would sort of as a bedrock of stability in these countries like Iran. Would that, talk about or discuss as sort of like a goal or a purpose of
yes.
American aid policy, I suppose? Or,
yeah. Walt's influence was, of course, very strong in the thinking of the administration. Take up the loan and all of that. But the concept of a middle class that would have a vested interest in a more open society was certainly there.
Now, when it came to foreign aid decisions, did you take part in like discussions of allocations of aid, like size of the shares of aid that would go to countries like Iran and other Middle Eastern countries? Was that one of those?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Did the size of allocations become an issue in U.S. Iran relations? Were there complaints about if we want more, we would like more money than this, or this is not enough? Or was this ever a problem, or was it?
I can't think of a single country where that kind of discussion didn't go on all the time. This was an administration that was focusing very heavily on growth and development around the world, particularly in the poorer countries. And that very fact encouraged a lot of these countries to press for substantial aid increases, and then these requests rapidly got beyond resources. The debates came in Washington as to the size of the aid package for a particular country, and the split between military and economic aid. Then the debate went on to particular types of programs. Should housing be a major priority, or roads and so on? The aid debate was carried on at all levels of government, starting, I guess, with the desks, the country desks in state and aid and Pentagon, especially, sometimes others, and then going to the assistant secretary level, where it really was a main feature, and in that really it was AID, Pentagon, and the NSC working with me that tried to hammer out decisions. We didn't often have to send disputed positions to the NSC officially. Occasionally it would happen.
It was done formally, usually. Did the AID, I guess the State Department, when I worked with the AID, did they try to induce the Iranians to make like internal reforms like financial stability, financial stabilization programs? And
oh, yes.
Was that part of the effort? Was that ever successful? Was that difficult to carry through? It was difficult to influence other countries' financial fiscal policies. And how was that? And like in the case of Iran, was that successful or difficult to accomplish?
Iran, of course, as an oil producer, didn't have the kinds of problems that countries like India had. And therefore, it was a different sort of situation in Iran. Even as early as the early 60s, we thought the Shah was pushing for greater oil revenues as a way of getting more resources. And now the questions that we had in the early 60s, as I recall them, had to do more with the integrity of the financial process, the quality of the system of levying taxes. This has been misguided.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get to the modernize our tax system and so forth. Now, in order to induce a shot, I make internal reforms. The administration make any assurances as to his military security requirements? Was it ever assurances made that we'll give you certain military aid if you proceed to reform, or is that ever? That's probably, I thought it probably a two.
Yeah, it was a bargaining doesn't usually come in that simply.
Yeah.
Usually every decision is reserved till the end.
Mm-hmm.
And the petitioner, if he is a petitioner, knows that if he doesn't give on some things, he's unlikely to get much on other things.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really more of the pattern. Shah knew that there were elements in Washington that were resisting a substantial increase in military assistance on the grounds that more military assistance would begin to skew his public finances.
I think you might recall some members of the Senate, such as William Fulbright, like I said, Hubert Humphrey, were very critical of military aid programs in Iran. There have been hearings that were published recently that suggested that that thought was very dangerous implications. Do you recall how did the administration respond to those kinds of criticisms? How did they try to mollify senatorial critics? How Fulbright or
well, a number of us went up to testify on the Hill.
Uh-huh.
On the military side, there were two or three different arguments. One, we were continuing in general to support the Northern Tier concept of assistance to Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan as part of our regional posture. And this was before satellites, and therefore at a time when our ability to monitor Soviet missile and other developments depended upon stations that we had in those Northern Tier countries. And the Department of Military Assistance was necessary in order to provide the climate to keep those stations operating. And the second argument was that we too were concerned about over-militarization, but we felt that the proposed amounts struck a balance, and that the executive branch had looked at this very carefully and had concluded that the amounts requested would be a reasonable balance between military and economic aid.
Let me just turn this over. Talking about the military aid, the considerations around military aid. I think you're in the middle of the talk about that. You're saying the various considerations. I think you said, was there a third one you were saying?
No, these two were the two main ones that I think of.
Okay.
The question of Iran's military importance in the Gulf area was much less clear in the minds of some of us at that point than these other two considerations.
Iran turned to people in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. They finally, supported the administration's position,
pretty
basically.
Pretty well.
Now, one issue concerning military aid, I guess, came up before the Shah's visit in April 62, there was discussion in the NSC of a 5-year military assistance plan. But I guess it's tied to scaling, tied U.S. military aid to the Shah's efforts to reform his army, to scale it down a bit, because they felt the army was too large. They wanted to find a way to get to tighten it up a bit, reduce spending a bit. Do you recall that plan, those discussions of the plan?
Yes, although not in specific detail. There were quite a number in the administration, and I was one of them, who felt that some of the military funding in Iran was being wasted because of the Shah's sense of power and prestige and such. But you really did need to sort out some of the more basic human problems in the country at that time. This incidentally did not make me one of the Shah's great favorites. There was agreement finally in 62, was it? Yes. Mm-hmm. But for purposes of CENTO and for purposes of our relations with Iran, we should go a little more actively into the question of the Iranian military forces, especially since we were supplying so much of what they were using.
Do the pressure, the interest in getting the scale down a bit come from State Department or from AID, or who is the main interest?
I guess, we kept this group going, and it was a process, I would say, gradually finding the Pentagon view less accepted by the others. Until, in the end, we were able to get a U.S. government decision on some restrictions.
When the Shah visited in April 62, was there much planning or discussions of that visit and what the U.S. position would be?
Well, one of the things about state visits is that it does crystallize the mind better than almost anything else. Even a speech sometimes, which is the other great crystallizing factor in official policy. So that the briefing books for the president and for the secretary would really run down the whole list of things.
Did you meet with the Shah at that time? Or were you involved in the discussion?
Sure.
How would you characterize the Shah? What was your impression of him at that point? What recollections do you have?
He was riding fairly high. He had regained whatever assurance he'd lost in the 50s as a result of the Mossadegh thing. He was emerging into a kind of maturity, into being his own man, really. When I say maturity, I mean, on the one hand, he was already beginning to reduce his almost dependence on American advice in some fields. On the other hand, he was recognizing more clearly, I think, the consequences of his own actions in a number of ways. So when the visit came, the discussions were very serious and straightforward, and of course glamorous, because there were these two young couples that were brilliant about their appearances. And so from the general point of view, it was a spectacular visit, and from the substantive point of view, I thought at the time had achieved some better understanding of why it was that the Americans were saying some of these things, and why it was that the Shah was resisting or accepting. He was talking more in those days of having himself developed a lot of the ideas of broadening the public process, and this was what lay behind the White Revolution, for example.
In terms of the substance of the discussions with the Shah, was the main subject on military and economic aid, or was there other matters discussed as well?
Oh, he loved to discuss global security and strategic concerns, and so they also were very much on the agenda. And he also was glad to talk about what Iran was achieving, and as I recall, put on a very positive view of what was going on. And indeed, many things were going on. But he had started, for example, he started about that time, traveling schools for the Kurds and other migrant groups, so that kids that moved from one place to another in different seasons could have schooling. He developed a number of rural industries, many of them agri-industries. The road map was improving strongly. Things were happening.
In terms of this five-year military aid plan, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, what was his response to that? Was he friendly to it, or was it that it raised problems? Was it a plan to scale down his army? Was it
exactly?
Yeah,
exactly. One gets mixed up as to reactions of a particular moment and then reactions
at another time.
I can't remember with what grace he accepted that something along these lines would be necessary if he were going to continue to participate.
But he accepted it in general terms of the end, though, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
When you met with the Shah, was it with Rusk and other officials, or did you meet on a one-to-one basis at some point, or?
Not during that visit,
no.
When I was touring the area, I would call on him, and usually with the American ambassador, so that the two of us, and he might be alone, and discuss the arrangement for everybody. But in Washington, he was there as head of state, and the principal on the American side was usually either the president or the secretary of state. My recollection is he also met with the senatorial committee, but I'm not certain.
One of the minutes of the meetings that I did see suggested that he wanted to have a joint session of Congress. Was that, in fact, even if no one's president, or if it was a very small attendance, he still wanted a joint session for reasons of prestige. Was that arranged by the State Department, or did they try to induce Congress to...
Did it happen?
I'm not quite sure. Maybe it fell through.
He certainly met members. But I don't remember just exactly the context.
Okay.
That incidentally was a very common kind of request when a leader was coming. And the Congress itself resisted having it happen very often.
Did you have a hand in monitoring the five-year plan? You mentioned that you take any role like overseeing its implementation in general terms in following years, or was this more of a Pentagon concern, unless it was agreed upon? Do you recall anything about
it? The details were Pentagon's responsibility, but the State Department was getting reports, and each year would look at the situation before going along for the next request to Congress.
You mentioned you visited Iran at some point. Was there several visits you made, or just...
Yes.
These were part of just tours of the region, basically?
Yes, normally an assistant secretary would go tour the region maybe once a year, depends, more often sometimes, not get to every country every year.
What were your impressions? What was your first visit to Iran? Do you recall? Was it 61 or 62?
61.
Okay. What were your impressions of the country at that point? That's the best, you know, so you can recall anything specific about the visit or your impressions?
In a number of ways, it was ahead of South Asian countries like India. But there were many similarities, more similarities in my mind than the Iranians were prepared to accept. Iran thought of itself as being more advanced, and it was I think they did not like my even comparing Iran and India. Although in the countryside, it seemed to me that there were many, many similarities, and even in the cities. I felt that, unlike the situation in India, in which mass political involvement had been developed by Gandhi and Nehru and the others, and there was a real sense of participation, this did not exist in Iran. It seemed to me it did not exist in Iran as much as it did in Turkey, although much more than in Afghanistan. I suppose during that period I was somewhat skeptical of the claims that Iran was on the threshold of becoming a modern, semi-democratic state with a constitutional monarch. Although I was one of those who believed that was a good direction for it to pursue.
I guess it didn't have the kind of colonial struggles that India had gone through. Like I said, that's right. Probably the key factor. There was no popular movement against colonial presence that. Who did you meet? You met the Shah when you were in your visits, basically? Was there another high officials there? Or,
yes. Yeah. Well, normally, in such a visit, uh-huh. one would meet a variety of people, members of the cabinet, some military people, the head of the central bank, some academic people, perhaps. There would be a dinner party at the embassy with a collection of people. Sometimes some political figures, depending on the current mood and so on. And I felt that perhaps because of my prior Asian experience, I could get around and I could meet with different people and get some sense of their views.
In August 62, Ali Amini resigned as Prime Minister. I think the one reason stated was that he failed to get USAID to finance a budgetary deficit. But I imagine there might have been more to that. Do you recall anything about his resignation or State Department reactions to his resignation?
This was a disappointment.
Yeah.
We did not feel responsible for covering his deficit, and felt that there were a number of issues in which a country like Iran had to face up to its own problems and do something about them. I think that he was having trouble influencing the Shah in making certain changes and certain reforms, and that if he'd seen a better chance of carrying through some of these reforms in the next year or two, he might want to resign. I think it's also possible Shah got tired of hearing him press such reforms.
Did this incident lead to sort of like maybe sort of a collapse of expectations that the Shah would turn into sort of a constitutional monarch? Was there some, are there any hopes before they more or less put aside, or was it, were there still hopes in the long term that this would will work out that way.
I think the skepticism began to grow. From then on, Michelle, began building up to, I'm afraid that's cold. Began building up to the coronation. He had previously said he didn't want to have a coronation until the country was well on its way to achieve certain things. I can't remember the timing, but I think the skepticism was beginning to grow.
After Manny resigned, was there still efforts to encourage Ambassador Holmes to meet with the Shah and press for certain social changes or political changes? Was there still efforts to?
Yes,
this was before the Red Revolution. I think the Red Revolution was in January 63, I think.
Well, but the build-up had been the preceding 2 years,
that's true.
Almost, and getting it to develop the plan set and so on. So it was part of the picture during that period.
But you were saying about Holmes?
Holmes was getting anxious that we were pressing the Shah too hard on some of these modernization or some of the economic changes or opening up the system. And whereas there have not been overt indications recently, as I recall, of neutralism on the Shah's part. Holmes felt it was still a sensitive and fragile situation, and if pressed too hard, the Shah might indeed go in another direction. And there were a number who supported him on this, as I recall. I think this anxiety was very strong in Pentagon. We all shared it to some extent, although some of us felt that the Shah's options were not as broad as that, and that really the danger to him of not opening up the system remained greater than the danger of neutralism.
The Shah, I guess in early 63, the Shah had made a major announcement about the White Revolution in terms of a land reform program, education reform, and so forth. When he made this announcement, was there any prior consultation with Holmes or other officials in Washington? Was this a sort of surprise that he would announce this, program of land reform, for example, and other social changes? This is what building up, as you suggested, but was there, did this seem to be a sort of turning point, in a sense?
I don't remember.
I don't know. Okay.
Now,
another development in 63 was, I guess in March, spring of 63, President Kennedy asked for a review of policy towards Iran under what's called NSAM 228. Which I guess led to the development of a major State Department paper on policy towards Iran. Could you comment about this policy review? Does this ring any recollections?
Yes, it does. Again, the details.
Right.
Pretty far back.
Yeah.
I think there may be some people still around who participated in the actual work on that paper.
Go ahead and talk to Ted Simone. His recollections were also very vague, also. I had the impression that the Budget Bureau might have had some role in initiating it. A person named Kenneth Hauser, an official there. Do you recall anything?
Hansen,
that's right. Kenneth Hansen.
Yes. He came into it rather curiously from the point of view of some of the others. He had lived out there. He had some pretty strong views, as I recall, which he was pushing. And these views didn't necessarily accord with those that I would describe as the consensus. Is that paper available?
Yeah, the impression I have from the document that I've seen is that he was trying to push for a more aggressive stance towards internal development programs. He thought there wasn't a comprehensive development program he wanted the Shah to adopt. And he was saying that Holmes wasn't pressing the Shah hard enough.
Yes.
That's one.
Yeah.
That's sort of the gist of his position, I think.
But I mean, is the NSAM, is the final paper of it?
Yeah, the response to it is available. Parts are sanitized, but...
Okay. Yeah. But my recollection is that we went through this, did not accept the Hansen position.
Yeah.
Felt that the degree of pushing that we were doing, you know, really couldn't be changed very much without some results that we were either unsure of or didn't like. And so it was, so often happens with government papers, a justification of the line we were on with not much change.
So it's sort of continuity of basic policy.
Yeah,
because one of the documents I did see was a standing group meeting in which Harriman was there with George Bundy, in which suggested there was a consensus in favor of intervention, but the question was how much intervention was possible. And you suggested that if you go too far, you might precipitate basic problems in U.S.-Iran relations, and it would be in a certain situation if we press the Shah too hard. But there was a consensus that some intervention was necessary, though, apparently. But also for how much intervention would be taken, or along what lines. But they did use the term intervention, and that was the sort of parameters of the...
There were groups that by then had developed an interest. I suspect that Bobby Kennedy was interested in pushing the Shah harder by then. But Hansen did represent some people on the... I mean, his views represented the views of some people on the Hill. Some people, you might call it the fringes of the policy management group, but that we kept moving in an effort to push aside to a degree, but not. The kind of pressure that would raise some of these questions of nutrients and more. Or a reaction by the Iranian military against us and so on.
For example, the state paper suggested that it would be possible to use some influence to ensure that the Trump government was worked out in a way in which we had a rational land tenure system, for example, to find some ways to ensure the land reform operated in an efficient way. Was that something that was discussed with Holmes and the Shah, and how the programs would work out in practice? Do you recall anything of that? It's just hard. I often use that one paper, so it's hard to say how it was implemented.
Certainly, Holmes was party to all these discussions.
Yeah, yeah.
But as I suggested, he was not inclined to push terribly hard on this.
Yeah.
We got assurances that certainly that attention would be paid to these issues. I can't argue that the assurances were satisfactorily kept in all cases.
Mm-hmm. It's a difficult question.
It really is. And of course, many things are more complicated than they seemed at that time to people in Washington.
Mm-hmm. I guess it was the minutes that I saw of the standing group meeting that suggested that it would be useful to have a greater World Bank role in Iran, because would advice from a multilateral institution would be more acceptable than advice from a great power like the United States. Was there efforts to induce the World Bank to take a greater role in foreign aid efforts there? Did you, is that something you worked on? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
And indeed, the World Bank in those days was developing its interest in systems and how effective the systems were being carried out. And we did think it true that it was easier to get multinational, multilateral pressure on a country like Iran or Pakistan or whatever than to do it all ourselves.
Was the World Bank responsive to those suggestions that they take a greater part?
They thought very well they were doing it, indeed to an extent they were. Mm-hmm. So they were responsive to the need, and said, yes, they were involved in it. Mm-hmm.
Another development in 1953 was that the Ayatollah Khomeini began a campaign against the Shah and U.S. influence in Iran, which led to an uprising in the summer of 1963 that the Shah suppressed, apparently, with force. At this time, did U.S. officials take any special note of Khomeini? Were they aware of his developing influence, I guess, in the population?
They were very much aware that he could stir things up, cause troubles from his base in Iraq at that time, as I recall. There was, I can recall very little of any sympathy for him, because he did seem to be pushing the obscurantist view. And the Shah was convinced that the clergy in Iran was a negative influence in terms of all these ideas of modernizing and opening up the system. But that it was so far out of date that it could be managed. I think much later on, the Shah had a basic mistake when he cut off the state allowances to the mullahs, because that kind of mobilized them to support actions against him. But at this early stage, that hadn't come up. It was a time when there were a variety of vociferous tendencies, as the Indian Jobbies call them. The Kurds were in some turmoil too, and there were questions as to what the Arabs in the southern province of Iran, which is Iraq, what influences they were under. So my recollection is we saw that as part of the general insecurity of the country. But not as the one that would succeed when others failed.
There's this uprising that took place in 1963 in major cities, apparently. Was there any special, I guess, U.S. support for the Shah at this period, moral support or otherwise, to bolster his position against his opponents? Do you recall anything about the U.S. response at that time?
I don't remember anything special or anything, but I just don't remember.
Yeah.
We were getting reports on the Shah's decisions and actions to control it, and I would think we encouraged him to control it soon, didn't we?
Generally, you mentioned
that again, that this was an example of how he needed to broaden his base of support to avoid that.
And you mentioned earlier that there's sort of like some emerging concern about human rights problems in Iran. How much concern was there about the Shah's treatment of his domestic opponents? And was there efforts to get him to loosen up a bit? Or was
there was concern, and a feeling that Savak was given his head rather more than was advisable or wise. The Shah was antagonizing elements in the society, we would have said unnecessarily about what he was doing. and that he needed again to broaden the base so he could avoid feeding the need for this.
Was this something that Holmes, Pastor Holmes, or you ever brought up in your discussions with the Shah? This question, it was a very touchy question to bring up the head of state, but was it ever approached in some kind of indirect way or direct way? Did you recall?
It certainly was brought up, how directly or indirectly, I don't remember, because as you say, yeah. Yes, of course it's delicate. On the other hand, there were people in Washington who felt very strongly about it, and it was important for the Shah to know how people in Washington felt. Now, if you asked me to guess how it was done, my guess would be that speeches in Congress were given to the Shah, so he could read from this kind of thing.
There was a concern of the Congress at the time also?
Concern of the Congress, but also, as I said, some elements of the administration.
The question of anti-Shah activities amongst Iranian students in the United States never come to your attention. Was this ever an issue in U.S.-Iran relations? Mm-hmm. Question of the dissidents in this country that were studying, ever in the schools?
Indeed it was. Yes. I remember a telephone call from Iran, who was foreign minister at one point, saying he was caught in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York and couldn't get out because there were demonstrators outside. What could I do about it? We were very much aware of two things. One, we had a lot of Iranian students in this country. Some of them governmental students, some of them private students, but all around. Two, that there was a lot of anti-Shah sentiment among them. Three, that through the so-called education minister at the Iranian embassy, the Iranian government was making strong efforts to control them. So it was a difficult situation.
A former official told me that there was a meeting between Robert Kennedy and some of the student dissidents that took place in 1963. Do you recall anything about that?
I remember that they called on him, that he received them. We had thought that it was unwise for him to receive them personally. He did it anyway. He listened to their complaints. He gave them some assurances that the U.S. legal and judicial processes would be followed out in this country. In other words, that we would not permit outsiders to come in and by having put our laws and dealing with individuals. He was somewhat careful, though, in what he said to them, actually. It was a symbolism of his receiving them that caused anxieties.
Did this get back to the Shah, or were there complaints about this?
Yes, I had the Iranian embassy ambassador in my office immediately complaining about it.
How would you respond to that kind of situation?
By pointing out that the ambassador knows American life, and the cabinet members have a certain freedom of action. Sorry if you felt that the U.S. government was encouraging these people by this, whereas in fact, as the Attorney General had said, we were following American laws exactly on this. And we would be as happy as he if the Iranian students could have more enthusiasm for their government.
I'm sure they're not too pleased with that response, for sure. All in all, looking back at the Kennedy administration, how would you characterize the state of U.S.-Iran relations during this period?
seems like there were some troubled moments, as you're suggesting. Was it?
Yeah. Oh, I'd say that the Kennedy administration was hopeful of an improved relationship, of improved conditions within Iran, that it regarded the Iranian relationship as important, regarded the Shah with both appreciation and skepticism, and therefore that supported the Shah on major activities, it sought to draw the Shah in to policy discussions more widely than just Iran, and it pressed the Shah, if that's the verb, to do a better job at home. The Kennedy administration wanted to see the central area, the northern tier countries, increase in prosperity and justice and modernization. So it was, if you will, a middle course between cutting off the Shah because we don't like to deal with dictators on the one side, and on the other side embracing the Shah as happened in the 1970s.
Well, after Lyndon Johnson became president, late 1963, was there any noteworthy shift or modification of policy towards the Shah, or did it continue pretty much on the same basis under Johnson?
My impression is it continued pretty much on the same basis. Iran was, my impression is that Iran was not at the top of his agenda, I remember that, that he had less of the, if you will, missionary zeal to try to see conditions corrected in other countries. My recollection is that by then we didn't find issues in Iran quite as compelling for us in relation to other issues in the area. This bureau, as I mentioned, was handling also the Arab-Israel problems, and also Greek, Turkey, Cyprus, and in 1964 we had a major Cyprus crisis. Also Iran and Afghanistan, Pakistan and Afghanistan, at a time when Pakistan closed the Afghan border and forced it into doing all this trade with the Soviet Union, except for the little bit that went to Iran. And of course India, Pakistan, 1965 war, so there were a good many other things happening in that part of the world that as I recall meant that somewhat less energy went into the question of our relationships with the Shah.
There was some sort of relaxation of interest in pressing for reforms, or to some extent
some relaxation of pressing for reforms, yes.
On the one issue that came out in 1954 was the updating of the military agreement that under which the government of Iran would exempt U.S. military personnel from prosecution under local law. This issue, do you recall that you discussed or dealt with when you were Assistant Secretary of the State Department?
This was an issue which is coming up then with respect to several countries as part of the nationalist upsurge. And it arose in, as I recall, Pakistan, maybe Thailand, some other countries as well. And it was an awkward issue for the U.S. because on the one hand we have traditionally not required extraterritoriality, and on the other hand to have American soldiers on duty there subject to local jurisprudence could raise some very difficult questions. Because soldiers do get drunk and they have accidents in their cars, they do make women pregnant and all this kind of thing. And so we were trying to resist that pressure if we could. You may know how it came out. My recollection is that we saved most of it, perhaps giving around some jurisdiction over certain types of cases or something.
Stop this turn this over.
How much about the Iranian reaction to this treaty?
Well, I know that there were Iranian influences that didn't like it, but I guess I don't really remember the details.
Okay. I've also read that public opinion polls in the early 60s showed that young Iranians had a rather critical view of the U.S. role in Iran and U.S. policy. The polls show that they thought, for example, that the U.S. is propping up the status quo, or that the U.S. aid was designed to help make the rich richer and things like that. All of these polls that were taken, I guess USIA or something like that. But was there any effort to influence opinion in Iran to try to change the U.S. image in the public mind?
Well, this was USIA's mission, of course.
Yes, of course.
And it was a mission that, in some respects, was very successful, in other respects, not at all. This was a time when Iranians became increasingly keen to get to this country for education or whatever. When our libraries in Tehran and other cities, the USIA libraries, were full, people coming to get at books to read. If I would describe it as the non-opinion cultural relationships with Iran were very strong. The U.S. had culturally and intellectually in its universities and so on, what lots of young Iranians wanted. In the opinion field, we faced the same problems in Iran that we did and have done in so many countries of the world, including which the Russians always express, that the American people are good people, but the government is bad. And the argument precisely in Iran was as it has been in Pakistan, in the Philippines, in many other countries, that we were supporting a dictatorial regime rather than the people of the country. Wherever there are dictatorships of the left or of the right, this is the kind of issue that comes up. We live with the charges, try to have enough programs that reach out to the people to blunt those charges, but as I say, the attitudes and opinions expressed on this issue tend to diverge sharply from the cultural relationships in terms of what individuals really want out of life. It's a phenomenon of our day.
Yes. What kind of efforts were there to influence the opinion forming elites in countries like Iran? Did they, were there efforts to influence the press there, or what were the information programs that were carried?
The information programs included a whole variety of things. We sent cultural groups of various kinds to Iran for performances or whatever. We sponsored academic seminars and conferences. We would bring Iranian and American scholars together. We put out various publications telling more about American lives and emphasized such things as community debates about policy, the kinds of things we hoped that Iran might pick up. We had some scholarships and fellowships for Iranians to come here. And we tried to be in touch with a lot of Iranians outside the court circles.
Was this a function in which the CIA, the agency, participated in any way in terms of more covert information programs or covert efforts? There are plenty of other countries that have documentation about efforts to influence the media and so forth. Was this ever the case in Iran, or that you can recall?
I don't recall. I don't. The agency in Iran had two missions, really. The principal mission was to develop a channel of information about the Soviet Union and Eastern European blocs. So, in other words, much of the work of the agency was external to Iran. The agency also reported on political attitudes and so on in Iran.
So those are the two main functions, sort of reporting in terms of Iran being a border country, monitoring. How valuable or useful did State Department officials find CIA evaluations of the situation in countries like Iran? Their evaluations of stability, their prognosis for the near-term future and so forth?
They became pieces in the mosaic of judgment. Uh-huh. And sometimes these were big and important pieces. Sometimes they were not. They had to be analyzed and judged the way anything else would be. Sometimes the agency would report that a particular person strategically placed one night when he was upset about something, had poured out his heart on one thing or another. This could be really quite interesting. other things could just duplicate what the consuls or the political officers in the embassy were picking up from their routine from the embassy.
Another thing that came up in 64, I guess the Shah approached the U.S. government for foreign military sales credits. Do you recall anything about that, approach? The effort to get, FMS credits, as they're called, I guess, foreign military sales?
This was one of the techniques, of course, by which recipient countries got a bit more than was possible through the regular aid legislation, through the grant aid legislation. I'm sorry, I don't remember any discussion about
it. I've read that Johnson was, at first, reluctant to approve the request, but later on approved it when he met with the Shah in June of 64. Do you recall anything about that visit, the state visit in the mid-64 by the Shah?
I guess I don't recall very much about it. It was a successful visit again in that we were able to get some points over, he got some points over. The relationship was strengthened rather than weakened. And as I said, I think we pushed less hard that time on some of these changes.
Okay. Did arms sales issues come up very often? Questions of the Shah request for special weapons systems, or was that an issue that came up in discussion with the agency?
Yeah.
Did the State Department have any
The Shah was ambitious for modernization of his armed forces. And I would have to say that in our little group, there continued to be divided opinions, but not very strong support for the Shah's ambitions.
Was the Pentagon more responsive? Perhaps, or not
sometimes, sometimes.
Were there any pressures for arms sales, like commercial interests that were pressing for to make a sale to Iran? Was that ever a problem at this point? It wasn't ever on, but
it didn't come to my level. It was. I think the commercial people usually work more in the environments of the Pentagon than the State Department.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier about petroleum funds, the Shah's interest in increasing the share of income from petroleum revenue. Was this something that he brought up from time to time in terms of his share of income from the consortium operations? Is that a question that came up?
Yes, he was convinced that the producers only had a larger share of the profits of the industry, and that he was pressing the producers in Iran to change the terms of the contract. The British, of course, were strong in their oil industry in Iran at that time, so they took a lot of this heat, but they kept us in court.
Well, what did the State Department have a response to the Shah brought these things up? What kind of a response did it make?
I don't recall that we took it as a matter of principle very strongly at that point. It was a question really of the Shah's negotiation with the companies.
So it's left to that, at that level.
And at that stage, it was all within the context of 3 hour oil, or whatever the exact figure was.
So during 1963 to 1965, Senator McClellan chaired hearings on charges made by an exiled tribal leader named Kadar Khan. He apparently charged that the U.S. aid funds were diverted to the Shah's court, and the Shah's family, and so forth, which I guess McClellan Hill held hearings on these by a special operations committee or subcommittee. Do you recall, is this being an issue that came up with the Shah's representative through the embassy?
The detailed hearings, as I recall, were handled mainly by aid. It seems to me that, again, the Iranian ambassador was very unhappy that this was happening. And we had the feeling that this was part of our process. And there was nothing to be done about it except to try to be sufficiently responsive with information to disprove whatever charges he made.
Do you know how the issue was resolved? I'm not quite sure about it myself, about what happened in the end. But the phone stopped his hearings at some point. But
I don't remember.
Okay. By 1955 or so, how did U.S. officials see the situation in Iran? Did they more or less assume that the Shah was taking a course that could assure him a more secure position over time in terms of his internal reform program? Were they fairly confident about his position at this point compared to, say, the early 60s?
I think there was a belief that he'd made some progress. It was disappointment he hadn't done more. And there was anxiety because some of the vulnerabilities had not yet been taken care of. I think there was an opinion that we would be dealing with him for quite a long time, and that we were only partially influential in our dealings with him.
Are there any other major developments that I haven't mentioned that you can recall that might be worth talking about? There any incidents or issues which we haven't covered up to this point?
If there are, they don't come to my mind right now.
I forgot to ask you earlier. You went to Iran. Who were some of the major personalities that you dealt with besides the Shah? Do you have any recollection of any specific individuals in the Shah's cabinet that left an impression with you, one or the other?
If I could dig back to my old date books, fairly closely. I'd rather not mention one or two because I may be forgetting the ones that are more important.
That's okay. Yeah. So in 1955 you became ambassador to Greece, and later on you were president of the Asia Society. Yeah. Did you have any connection with Iran, Iranian issues at any of those later years, or was it pretty much off your agenda?
It was pretty much off the agenda.
Yeah, yeah,
now,
yeah.
In the Asia Society, we would occasionally have an Iranian exhibit or program of some kind that I would meet people. My one other substantial contact with Iran was attendance at a symposium arranged by Shahbanu in Persepolis in 1974. You've seen that book, have you?
I think so.
This was arranged really by the Aspen Institute and brought an international group of people to listen to technocrats in Iran talk about what they were doing and to react, to comment. And it was a very interesting session.
What were your impressions? You spent time in Iran at that point. What were your impressions of the country compared to, say, 10, 12 or years earlier? What did you see?
Signs of real development in a variety of ways. More factories. Again, the same litany almost, that the roads were better. There seemed to be a broader educated group than there had been. Education has certainly got farther into the villages. A number of these indices looked better. It was interesting in retrospect that one of the critiques offered by the foreign participants in that conference was the question as to whether in this pell-mell push for modernization, and by that time the Shah had said he wanted to make Iran the next Italy, whether enough attention was being made to keeping the country cohesive and involving everybody, or whether some fragmentation would be possible.
Did you see the Shah at that point? Did you meet with him?
No, did not. The Shah Banu, at that point, I think, was trying hard to introduce some influences to counter what by then had become, these are my words, certainly not hers, more megalomaniac. With less sensitivity to what the opposition utopias were doing. Somewhere in that period of the increase of oil prices, the Shah concluded that he could do it on his own, and the Americans and everybody else would have to listen to him. This made it more difficult to deal with. Again, I don't know what Douglas MacArthur may have said to you, but it seemed to me that that was a time when the Shah was on a track that was bound to cause trouble for us. And George Wall has identified the turning point as about 1972. And I think that probably is right.
In terms of expansion of arms sales and the militarization.
Exactly. And as Gary Six says, the kind of abrogation of American independent judgment as to things in Iran, the Nixon Kissinger approach, that the Shah is our man, and therefore we support him, and we'll accept his judgment on what's to be done, what's not to be done, and provide an arms aid and so on. It was an extraordinarily different approach to Iran from the one that we had in the 1960s.
Well, I appreciate your time with us.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Well, I should be interested in...